It took 80 years of research following the lives of hundreds of men over 80 years to come up with the secret to happiness. The Harvard Study of Adult Development has collected data on these men since 1938. Some had just started their second year at Harvard in 1938, including President John F. Kennedy. Others were young men from a disadvantaged neighbourhood in Boston. Now, what all that data tells the keepers of the research is that one thing helps us stay healthier and happier. One thing. And it's good relationships. Professor Mark Schultz is the Associate Director of the study and co-author of The Good Life, Lessons from the World's Longest Scientific Study of Happiness. And Mark joins me now. Hi there.
Hi, Jesse. Pleasure to be with you.
We're used to people obsessing about happiness in 2023, eh? But I wonder if when the study started in 1938, was that actually the question they were looking to answer? It's kind of a modern quest.
It is a modern twist and a way of thinking about things, but unusually, these studies, which initially were two separate studies, the inner city boys that were studied in Boston and the students at Harvard University, in both studies, they were interested in what makes human beings thrive in their life, what helps them flourish. So it was really a study, it was unusual for its time because it was focused on what we now think about as positive psychology, the factors that underlie thriving as opposed to pathology or disease of some kind. Huh. They didn't talk about happiness, though. It was about human flourishing is what they were interested in.
Yeah, although actually, as you try and define happiness in 2023, thriving's not a bad place to start.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. We can't be happy all the time. Yeah. So certainly the good life is about more than just momentary happiness, for sure.
Can you measure happiness? And I guess a bit of a meta question, can the act of trying to measure it change it?
Yeah, two really important questions. So I think we can measure happiness. It's done worldwide now. They're the national happiness surveys that are done around the world that have attracted some attention. And it's a pretty simple measure. Essentially ask people about how their lives are going, how satisfied they are. You can also ask people about their emotional states at various points during the week and see how happy or joyous people are as opposed to feeling sadness or other kinds of negative feelings. So I think we have fairly reliable measures of people's experience of happiness. In our study, we take that a few steps forward and we look at them and their interactions with other people that they care about. So we observe them. We bring them into the lab and we watch how they navigate challenging tasks and how quickly they can recover to either a neutral or a positive state. So there are a number of ways to get in and measure happiness. The second question you ask is a really interesting one. Does studying people, particularly their thriving or their happiness, does it change them in certain ways? And our participants, after 85 years of being, you know, poked and prodded and studied, they tell us that the study was an important part of their life, which is a hint that maybe it did make a difference. It provided regular check-ins. So we followed these people very closely with interviews and questionnaires quite regularly. And I think they found it a kind of helpful way to check in about where their priorities were in their life, to think about what was working well or not. So it wouldn't surprise me that we've changed their lives in certain ways.
Yeah. Again, it's quite a modern, I guess, breakthrough, isn't it? That if you observe your mental state from a distance or sort of on a regular basis, it can be a way of not letting it overtake you and not feeling sort of victim to moods and other sort of things that might, other sort of emotional weather.
I think there are parts of it that are modern and parts of it that have been around for a long time, right? So the idea of an examined life is worth living, that we have lots of precedent in ancient wisdom about the value of examining our lives. And certainly in the 1930s, when the study started, the men who were part of the study, they were socialized not to really talk about their emotions, to hide them and to control them. So the wording you chose is really interesting to me, because I think that this idea that we somehow conquer and control our emotions was actually something that was very much a part of the growing up in the 1920s and 30s of the participants in the study. I think we're at a point in history, kind of modern times, when maybe emotions aren't as scary, at least for some people, that emotions are part of life and not necessarily to be controlled, but just experienced. So we can talk more about that. But I think an examined life is something that, you know, people have talked about for years, some of the benefits of that. And I should say millennia more than years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what sorts of questions did you ask people in the study to gauge happiness? And I guess corollary of that, what should we be asking ourselves as a way of kind of taking stock?
So again, study has existed for 85 years, actually. If I do my math right, I think this is the 85th year. And we've asked them thousands of questions and taken, you know, thousands of measurements. We measured their bodies at the beginning because there was an idea that researchers had that the shape of your body was related to your personality and how likely you were to thrive in certain situations. So the ways in which we measure the variables that are important to us have changed as science has grown and the technologies have grown. So we certainly ask people about their happiness and their well-being and their sense of satisfaction and meaning in life. We also use brain scans and modern physiological assays. We take their blood and look at their expression of genes and markers of immune functioning and inflammation in the blood as well. But for those of us that aren't part of the study, I think just checking in and thinking about what drives those connections, it's our relationships in particular, sort of how am I doing? Am I satisfied with what my life is like? Am I doing the things that are important to me? And particularly thinking about your connections with others. So checking in on what we call our social fitness is really critical. Are my relationships thriving? Are there ones that I'd like to improve? Am I seeing the people that I really enjoy being with and give me a sense of, you know, life and connection to others? How can I maximize the time that I spend with those folks? That's the kind of reflection and introspection that I think is important.
I love this one, and I'd love each of our listeners to think about it. Who would you call in the middle of the night if you were sick or scared?
Right. So that was a question that we asked all of our participants, and we got a range of responses. Some people listed, you know, quite a large number of people that they felt like they could call, and some people listed no one, that they felt very much alone. And this was part of our attempt to understand, you know, relationships give us many things when we start to unpack it and we study it. Relationships help us figure out who we are, so they're important to our identity. They certainly help us navigate stress. And there's so many kinds of support that relationships can give us. And this was one way of asking about whether someone really has your back when you're in trouble.
Yeah.
A really critical part that's important in life.
How about this one? Find a photograph of yourself when you were about half as old as you are now and ask yourself, what were you thinking about back then? And when you think of yourself at that time, what do you regret? What is the value of thinking about your past self?
So this is something we talk about in our book, The Good Life. It wasn't actually part of the study, but our intent there was to have readers think about how the point at which they're at in life, the point in the lifespan that they're at currently, how that perch is different than it was than they were maybe half as old or 30 years ago or whatever age you are. And to think hard about what mattered to you, what your priorities were, to recognize that someone who's not at your particular life stage may have a different outlook on life and a different set of priorities. They may look at things differently. So this was an attempt to kind of help people time travel in the service of kind of perspective taking, in the hopes that people might be interested to learn about people at different life stages. So we always have someone who's ahead of us, right? And easy and kind of interesting and worthwhile for sure to ask them about what they're thinking about, what life is like at that next stage of life. Mm. But it also helps us to think about where we've come from and how we've changed, right? So, you know, what were you like when you were half this age? So for me, that's my 30s. I'm thinking about it as we're talking, Jesse. What was I like and what was important to me?
Yeah. And we cover all sorts of studies on this show, but actually very rarely do we get to hear about the lives of the people who took part in the studies. That's one thing that makes your study different. Can you tell us about Rosa and Henry, for example? They had some pretty significant challenges in their early lives and in their married ones.
Absolutely. So Henry and Rosa, two of my favorite people in the study. Henry was one of the people that grew up in inner city Boston in Massachusetts. And he grew up in one of the poorest neighborhoods of Boston. Many of our participants grew up in small tenement buildings that were overcrowded without running water. This was, again, the 1920s and 30s. And Henry was one of them. He had a challenging childhood. His dad drank too much and had problems with alcohol. And there were some disappointments in his family. And he, as he grew up, started working in a factory, in a car factory, and had to change jobs. When he lost his job, he didn't have steady work, so continued to have different jobs. But he found a woman that he fell in love with, and he and Rosa formed an incredible partnership. And they both were people who were connected not just to each other, but to the people that they surrounded themselves with, including their daughter, Peggy, who's the one who we now study as part of the second generation, more than 1,300 of the children of the original participants. And they have a lovely connection. So we use Henry and Rosa to illustrate. We actually begin the book with a story about them in their 80s when we're asking them to tell us about the greatest fear that they have. And Henry, in particular, is very hesitant to talk about his greatest fear. And eventually, with some encouragement and obviously some familiarity with our study, he says his fear is that his wife will die. And that he'll be alone. Or that he had another fear, which was that he might die before her and leave her alone. So their connection was a kind of very prominent and out front part of who they were. And they were able to have these difficult conversations that are scary for many of us. As they were talking about this topic, they would reach out and touch each other's hands and kind of encourage each other. So this was an example of a kind of very positive connection in old age, and what we call a secure connection, one that you had trust and could rely on the person as a kind of base for continuing to explore life and thrive as you're getting older.
Really interesting too, given they did have all sorts of troubles, him getting laid off. He'd had a tough upbringing with his father, and I think one of the children got polio. Interesting to compare their reports of their life and the stresses in their life with their daughters, who actually remembers a very loving and affectionate and almost trouble-free upbringing.
That's right. Again, this was this beautiful connection they had with people they were close to, particularly their daughter Peggy. So when we asked her, when she became part of the study, to recall what it was like to grow up in the home that we had followed, remember, we had followed it over the years that she was growing up, but we asked her, what does she remember? And she confirmed what our data had suggested, that she grew up in a home in which she considered her parents to be very supportive and warm and close. I think she felt quite fortunate with that heritage. I think you're also pointing to something else really important. Henry grew up in very challenging and humble circumstances, had some success in his career or his work, but he also got laid off and had to begin his work in different places. But he was happy. He was someone who flourished in his life, and we think he flourished because of the connections that he built with others.
Can you, by the way, if you've just tuned in, I'm talking to Dr. Mark Schultz, Professor Mark Schultz. He's the Associate Director of a study in Harvard, the Harvard Study of Adult Development, and co-author of The Good Life: Lessons from the World's Longest Scientific Study of Happiness. We talked about the importance of relationships on health. Can you see that in the data? Can you see a connection between the people who were happy in, say, in their marriage and their health later in life?
We can, and it's not just in our study, because it's really important when we talk about findings to see them replicated, repeated across many studies. So in our study, if you look at midlife, it's the quality of your relationship with your partner that predicts the quality of your late life in terms of your health and your happiness, and even how long that you'll live in our study. And that was surprising to us when we found that. So for example, it's a better predictor than your cholesterol level at age 50. But these are findings that are now present in lots of other studies, and the clearest data are data about social connection. That increasingly we're seeing social connection or the absence of connection as an important factor in our physical health. So relationships we know get under our skin, they get into our body, they affect our ability to fight bacteria or viruses. They affect our inflammatory levels, which are important in our physical health and also our mental health. So we have clear indications from our research about the link between connections, and it's not just intimate connections, but other connections as well, and our aging, our physical aging, even our brain health. We have some data that suggests that the kind of connection that Henry and Rosa had, that close, secure connection in old age, may be a kind of protective factor as we age in terms of cognitive decline or the appearance of dementia.
How powerful a poison is loneliness?
Yeah, so on the opposite end, the absence of connection, particularly the subjective experience that you're alone, that there aren't people that have your back or know you well, is corrosive for our health. And it's very clear there are hundreds of studies now that show this, and the risk associated with the experience of loneliness is quite significant. It's on the order of smoking, about a pack of cigarettes, or obesity. So the physical risk is quite strong and real. And the problem, just like obesity, is that in our modern world, many people feel isolated. So it's quite prevalent across the world. About 20 to 50% of adults report feeling loneliness, at least some of the time. I think in New Zealand, it's about 20% from the latest surveys there. So this is a significant public health problem that I think a number of countries are now beginning to recognize and begin to think about what can we do about it.
Why do you think relationships are so powerful for the human body?
Yeah, this is an important question. It's a really a profound question. And one way to think about it is that if we think back to our evolutionary origins, that being social is what kept us alive, right? It protected us. So
Yeah.
being able to work with others kept us warm at night. It helped us fight invaders. It helped us find food and to protect others. So there was a strong sort of propensity to be social. And in the modern world, there are so many ways in which we are pushed to disconnect, to be isolated
Yeah.
from others. I think there's a belief and some evidence that being alone is literally aversive for our bodies. It's uncomfortable. It's a kind of stressor for our bodies. So that experience itself is uncomfortable. And part of that may be that it kind of, in a healthy way, it may promote us to seek connection. But the problem in modern life is that people get stuck in patterns and they're not able to have those connections in their lives. So I think this is why it's important to think about it as a public health problem, that we need those social connections. Our bodies are influenced greatly by them. I'm going to give one other example, which I think is quite interesting, and we talk about in the book. If you expose people to pain, and psychologists do these horrible things to people in studies, to mild pains, they might prick someone. And you look at the areas of the brain that typically light up that have to do with the perception of pain. If a person is able to hold the hand of someone else, and even better, hold the hand of someone who they love, they really care about, the perception of pain, the areas that are relevant to the perception of pain, don't light up as much in the scanner. So people's brain activity isn't signaling as much pain. And we also see that on a subjective level as well. When people are with others, particularly in old age, they're experiencing regular pains, they don't tend to perceive their pain as much, at least as severely as they might on days when they're not with others. So people, connections have this incredible power to influence our physical experience.
When it comes to relationships, can you see that quality is more important than quantity?
I think it is like I'm drawn to that answer, but I want to say it's a little bit complicated. When you look at studies, it's very clear that there's certain capacities or functions that relationships serve, and they're often kind of aspects of support, right? So when we're faced with stress, we might need help calming down our emotions and our physiology, and friends or people that we care about help us do that. They may also help us figure out a path forward or some information that we may not be aware of. So relationships can provide that supportive role. That's really critical. And a high quality relationship includes those kinds of support and trust. When you ask people, though, how many connections they have, the more connections people report, the healthier they are across many studies. Some of us believe, and I'm one of them, that the biggest difference is between saying, I have no one I can trust, which is a lonely person, and I have at least one person in my life who has my back, who I can call in the middle of the night. After that, studies suggest it still is connected. Having more people in your support network are connected with positive things, but the payoff may be smaller after you have that basic amount of support in your life. If I can, Jesse, one other thing I think is important is that, relationships serve so many functions that it would be surprising we could get all we need from one person in our life. So really important for your listeners to hear. I'm not talking about it that it doesn't need to be an intimate relationship or a partner, a longtime life partner. Most people are able to get the support across a bunch of people, not just one person. So we rely on different people. I have a friend that maybe I wouldn't call in the middle of the night. But when I need to have a good time, I want to kind of release some stress, that's the person I want to call. So we may have friends that give us or support figures that give us different kinds of support.
And if people are listening and finding this a bit depressing as they look at their own lives and maybe the relationships they've had to date, one of the major themes of your book and I think of the research is that it's never too late.
That's right. So we have a whole chapter. We titled it, It's Never Too Late. And one of the neat things about this study, again, it started in the 1930s, and it was one of the first studies to follow people forward from adolescence or the kind of right on the cusp of young adulthood into their adult life through middle age and into late life. And what we found was surprising in some ways that there was this idea in psychology that people are kind of fixed by the time they enter young adulthood and they don't change. Their personalities are kind of fixed and they don't develop. And in contrast, our study and then a number of other studies have found that we do develop in important ways through our lifetime and we change. And what we see in our study, which I think is really a message of hope, is that people who were quite miserable for long periods in their time, feeling like the good life was out of their reach because of their circumstances or prior experiences that they had, that they change. And they change sometimes because they intentionally work hard to change things in their life, often their routines and their connections to others, or they go through a transition of some kind in which their life opens up new possibilities. So they find a new job, or they move to a new city, or they take up a new activity that's really important to them. And along with that activity opens up a new set of possibilities that allows them to grow and to change. So this message that it's never too late, really important message from the research in the study.
Could we just finish with a couple of practical things people could do to improve relationships?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things that we can do, but I'll start with simple ones that we can start right now. So if you think about people in your life that are important to you, that maybe you want to spend more time with, or you just want to let them know how important they are, reach out to them. You could do that in the next 5 minutes. Send them a text, call them, tell them how important they are. Make an intention to spend more time with them. Let them know that you'd like to do that. Those are easy starts for people who have positive connections in their lives. For people who are feeling more alone and feel like they need to figure out a way to make those connections, think about something that excites you, an activity that you're interested in. Is there a way to do that along with other people? That when we build friendships, they build partly as a result of contact with each other. So doing something along with others repeatedly is a way to build up familiarity and to build up friendship. So do you want to volunteer? Do you want to do a new recreational activity of some kind? But think about an activity that you might engage in that might connect you to others. That's a really important start. The other one is a kind of just a more general thing that we often overestimate the likelihood that people will reject any invitation that we make to spend time with us. We're worried about being rejected or being hurt. And study after study suggests that we're biased in the negative direction, that we overestimate how likely it is for people to say we're strange or different or not desirable to talk with. And I'm talking about it in all kinds of contexts, strangers, even with our partners that we may live with. And I'm going to encourage people to be brave, that being vulnerable is really important in relationships, and figure out the ways that you're comfortable being vulnerable. Put yourself out there, could be with a stranger, could be with your partner, to really invite a connection and the opportunity for each of you to learn about each other. Really important.
And some of the stuff we know intuitively, I think, but it's really great to have a reminder, great to see the data behind it, and just so fascinating and rich to look through these years and years of insights and experiences. Thanks for the work you've done on it, Mark. Really nice to talk to you today, and good luck with the book. It's called The Good Life, Lessons from the World's Longest Scientific Study of Happiness, and I've been speaking to Professor Mark Schultz. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Jesse. Really a pleasure.